On This Week in Enterprise Tech, we talk a bit about whether ISPs are leading you on with their speed claims, should trademarks not be offensive, and we have our awesome guest on, Jess Sackowitz from Microsoft, to talk the Microsoft Graph. Twyatt on the set.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit.
Bandwidth for This Week in Enterprise Tech is provided by CacheFly at CacheFly.com.
This is Twyatt, This Week in Enterprise Tech, episode 245, recorded June 23rd, 2017. The Rise of the Graph.
This Week in Enterprise Tech is brought to you by GoCD, an on-premise open-source continuous delivery server by ThoughtWorks. GoCD gives you complete control of and visibility into your deployments across multiple teams. Since GoCD is open source, you can download and use it for free. To discover the power of their pipelines, visit gocd.io/twit. And by Cloudflare. More than 6 million websites, apps, APIs, and SaaS companies use Cloudflare's services to weather whatever the internet throws at them. For a free online chat session with a Cloudflare support engineer, visit cloudflare.com/twit.
Welcome to This Week in Enterprise Tech, the show that is dedicated to the enterprise professional, the IT pro, and the geek who just wants to know how this world is connected. I am your host for today, Louis Maresca, and I'm your guide through the world of enterprise. But this world is very big, and let's face it, folks, I need somebody to help me with that. So let's bring in my co-host in crime, Mr. Brian Chi. He's the director at Advanced Network Computing Laboratory in Honolulu. Chibert, you're getting ready for a bit of maker goodness tomorrow, aren't you?
That is true. I am going to be – actually, we've had My Devices people, Cayenne, on the show in the past, and I'm going to be doing a Raspberry Pi workshop, and we're going to use Cayenne. We're going to use waterproof temperature probes and some UL-listed power strips, so controllable power strips, to, in theory – create a saltwater aquarium heater.
Wow. Well, if that works, I want one for my office.
Yeah.
Well, folks, it's just two of us today. But we do have some great topics and a good guest to talk about the Microsoft Graph. But first, of course, as always, we'd like to just go ahead and jump into the blips. So you thought that your air gap PC was safe. Well. It's not. WikiLeaks has published an online some more top secret documents that it's actually obtained from the CIA. And this time, the leak details a software codenamed Brutal Kangaroo that agents can use to infect targets and target air gap computers with malware. The exploit compromises Windows PCs to spread malware to non-networked machines via USB sticks. So there's the old saying, never take a dirty USB stick from just about anyone or anywhere. Well, the software contained on this USB stick had four specific applications. Shattered Assurance is the server-side code that forms the basis of the attack, and it affects USB G drives plugged into an infected computer with the drifting deadline malware. Once plugged in, infected dumb drive is set up to auto-run its contents and using on a Windows 7 as the operating system, and it runs .NET 4.5, and drifting deadline deploys shadow malware under the system. If the machine was then ever connected to the network, it would then look for other vulnerabilities in machines connected. So next time someone gives you a USB stick, you might want to take a step back and consider where it's been.
Well, congratulations to Augusta University. This comes from a Twyatt viewer, and I'm happy to help spread the word that Augusta University has just opened a new School of Computer and Cyber Sciences. The school will have a full authority to present diplomas to computer science and information technology graduates. It will continue to offer a master's degree in information security management and bachelor's degree in computer science, information technology, and information technology with a concentration in cybersecurity. To our viewer, JJ to the 4884, and to Brooks A. Keel, president of Augusta University, I'd like to say congratulations on the new school.
Ever hear of security by obscurity? Well, Cloudflare didn't know they were doing it, but that's how some of their users' data was actually secured. Since it's been months since the leak, dubbed Cloud Bleed, more info has transpired of the massive leak. Found by mistake by security researcher at Google, Travis Ormandy, during fuzz testing of the Common Code, Cloud4 data might have been a huge hit on people's confidence. And they'll actually leak as a huge hit on people's confidence of cloud security. Cloudflare's content delivery network possesses roughly one-tenth of the world's internet traffic without a hitch in the past. As part of their true finding mission, Ormandy discovered that the company's server was splattering people's private data across the web. How did Ormandy get the attention of Cloudflare? Well, how else? Twitter, of course. Ormandy didn't think of calling the frontline support team because he didn't think they would actually be helpful. So he blasted a Twitter message, "Someone from Cloudflare Security, urgently contact me." This sent a waterfall effect across the company's leadership landscape, waking their CTO in the middle of the night to understand the ramifications of the leak. Google's Project Zero team had found a bug in Cloudflare's infrastructure, and it was a bad one, in fact. The servers that helped run more than 6 million customers' websites, including most of the FBI, NASDAQ, and Reddit, had sprung a data leak. Anyone can access Cloudflare's supported site and retrieve, in certain circumstances, the intimate details of their authentication tokens, cookies, private messages of users on another site of its network. Among them, Uber, 1Password, OkCupid, and Fitbit. Although Cloudflare was warned in private, Project Zero didn't want to wait for them to sit on it for too long, releasing the specifics of the leak before it had been mitigated. So this is something to think about. Was Ormandy's behavior and the way that Project Zero works at Google actually damaging the people's security versus helping it? There's another show about that sometime.
Anyway, I do have to say that Cloudflare is a sponsor of the Twit network. Anyway, going on. Ouch, an old bug has serious privilege implications for Nix variants. A raft of Unix-based operating systems, including Linux, OpenBSD, and FreeBSD, contain flaws that let attackers elevate low-level access on a vulnerable computer to unfettered root. Security experts are advising administrators to install patches or take other protective actions as soon as possible. Stack Clash, as the vulnerability is being called, is most likely to be chained to other vulnerabilities to make them more effectively execute malicious code, researchers from Qualys, the security firm that discovered the bugs, said in a blog post published Monday. Such local privilege escalation vulnerabilities can also pose a serious threat to server host providers because one customer can exploit the flaw to gain control over other customers' processes running on the same server. Qualys said it's also possible that Stack Clash could be exploited in a way that allows it to remotely execute code directly. Ow! Quote, "This is a fairly straightforward way to get root after you've already gotten some sort of user-level access," Jimmy Graham, Director of Product Management at Qualys, told Ars Technica. The attack works by causing a region of computer memory known as the stack to collide into separate memory regions that store unrelated code or data. Quote, "The concept isn't new, but this specific exploit is definitely new. The bottom line here is if you're running an old kernel version or if you've been remiss at updating, you really want to now. It used to be that limited access users weren't of limited danger, but this stack issue provides a path for privilege escalation that could mean even a brain-dead user could potentially get escalated to dangerous levels."
In the past, Gmail has been a little bit questionable when it comes to whether Google is looking into the context of your email in order to target more intimate-based ads for you. Privacy is it's a thick topic here, especially in enterprise, and we can talk about it at a later date, but people's email's contents is very specific. This has been a topic of multiple articles in the past and a bunch of backlash about these efforts around Google actually looking in your email. Finally, after another push from the communities and users, Google will soon stop scanning emails received by Google users as a practice, and they allow eventually no longer targeting advertisement. Where did this decision come from? Well, it definitely didn't come from the Google Ads team, but it did come from its cloud unit group. Why? Well, they want more enterprise and corporate customers to sign up, of course. If companies want to compete in the enterprise space, they're going to have to tug on the privacy strings a bunch. Google's cloud unit is starting to get the memo, finally. As Google's senior vice president of cloud, Diane Green, has said, what we're going to do is make it unambiguous. Although ads will disappear from paying customers, ads will continue to appear inside the free version of Gmail as a promoted message. Users now have to make the decision on whether they're still okay with their privacy on the free email tier.
Yet another ouch. A South Korean web host pays the ransomware to the tune of $1 million in Bitcoin. The South Korean web host Nayana said in a blog post published last week that initial ransom demands were for 5 billion won worth of Bitcoin, which is roughly $4.4 million US. Company negotiators later managed to get the fee lowered to 1.8 billion won and ultimately landed a further reduction to 1.2 billion won or just over $1 million US. An update posted Saturday said Nayana engineers were in the process of recovering the data. And the post cautioned that recovery was difficult and would take time. The blog post Monday, researchers from a security firm, Trend Micro, wrote, as for how this Linux ransomware arrived, we can only infer that Erebus may have possibly leveraged vulnerabilities or a local Linux exploit. For instance, based on open source intelligence, Nayana's website runs on Linux kernel 2.6.24.2, which was compiled back in 2008. Security flaws like Dirty Cow that can provide attackers root access to vulnerable Linux systems are just some of the threats it may have been exposed to. Additionally, Nayana's website uses Apache version 1.3.36 and PHP version 5.1.4. both of which were released back in 2006. Apache vulnerabilities and PHP exploits are well known. In fact, there was even a tool sold in the Chinese underground expressly for exploiting Apache struts. The version of Apache Nayana used is run as a user of nobody UID equals 99, which indicates that a local exploit may have also been used in the attack. Guys, I'm sorry. I feel for you. Good luck with this.
On a much lighter note, why not use AI to improve the world, reduce our carbon footprint, and maybe slow down global warming, right? Well, DeepMind, the artificial intelligence lab, which was acquired by Google for over $400 million in 2014, has said that it wants to use its self-learning algorithms to try to tackle some of the world's biggest challenges. And its current algorithms are already being used as part of the parent company Google, was able to slash the amount of energy used by cooling units in Google's power-hungry data centers by 40%. And its talks with the National Grid about using technology to reduce the UK's overall energy consumption as well. DeepMind is now focusing a good portion of its research on and resources on academia and supporting research from Cambridge to focus on climate change. Well, let's hope AI will save the world. DeepMind thinks so. Well, folks, that does it for the blips. But next up, we're going to get into the bites, and we have a couple fun ones. But first, we couldn't do This Week in Enterprise Tech without our supporters and our sponsors. And this one is no exception. Padre?
We'll get back to the action in just a bit, but let's take a moment to thank a sponsor of This Week in Enterprise Tech. And today we're thanking GoCD. Now, this episode of This Week in Enterprise Tech is brought to you by GoCD, which is an on-premise, open-source, continuous delivery server created by ThoughtWorks. With GoCD's comprehensive pipeline modeling, you can model complex workflows across multiple teams with ease. You can easily configure dependencies for fast feedback and on-demand deployment with its parallel and sequential execution. And that means it offers complete customization for your software's individual needs. Imagine that, a tool set that works for you rather than the other way around. Now, GoCD's real power is in the visibility that it provides over your end-to-end workflow. So you get complete control of and visibility into all of your deployments across the organization. This single pane of glass view is absolutely essential for those who are trying to run a deployment in a 24/7 environment. GoCD supports audible deployment and can delegate the configuration of pipelines to users without full-blown admin privileges. It will perform tests written in most languages or frameworks, and their test reporting is so detailed that it won't just tell you that, well, it's not working. It will tell you exactly in which chain set and on which platform a test started to break. That means you can compare content across any two arbitrary builds, making it invaluable when troubleshooting a broken pipeline. GoCD also has extension points for which plugins can be created, and numerous plugins are available where you can write your own. The TLDR is that you can say goodbye to deployment panic and hello to consistent, predictable deliveries. GoCD is an open source solution that you can download and use for free. Discover the power of their pipelines at gocd.io/twit. That's gocd.io/twit. Commercial support and enterprise add-ons, including disaster recovery, are also available. And we thank GoCD for their support of This Week in Enterprise Tech.
Thanks, Padre. Well, let's go ahead and move into the bites. This is actually an interesting one. So now you've kind of been wondering once in a while why they, you know, that charging of $69.99 per month deal where you expect to get 150 megabits per second, right? Well, then you notice that word to the right of it, up to, right? That up to 150 megabits in the advertisement. What does this actually mean? Well, up to, well, several states here in the United States are also wondering the same thing. In fact, the Attorney General is wondering himself. The Attorney General of New York, Eric Schneiderman, just recently filed suit against Charter Time Warner, claiming the ISP defrauded and misled New York residents by promising speeds the company knew they couldn't deliver. His quote, "The internet provider allegedly conducted a deliberate scheme to defraud and mislead New Yorkers by promising internet service that they knew they could not deliver. As part of the suit, they went to such lengths as doing a 16-month investigation, reviewing hundreds of thousands of subscriber speed tests found by the customers, where they were shortchanged on both speed and reliability. Some of the plans, 100 megabit, 200, and 300 plans, were up to 70% slower week over week from their speed claims. So what is that actually saying to us? Well, the proof's in the pudding. This is actually starting many suits and trends from many states against some of the largest cable companies in the country, as well as ISPs, to ensure that their citizens get what they promised. This isn't really making the ISPs too happy here, as this now sparked a campaign by lobby groups to enforce the up-to clause, meaning that they're pushing the FCC to actually declare the claim up to certain levels of megabits per second is consistent with the federal laws as long as ISPs meet their disclosure obligations under the net neutrality rules. They essentially want the federal government to put their foot down so the states can't. Another lobby group actually petitioned the FCC last Friday, not asking for a complete prevention of states to file suit, but wants a ruling that would make it far more difficult for states to protect the consumers from false speed claims. Not really sure if that's better or not. So what has this done? Well, it's sparked obviously a bunch of consumer advocacy groups to plea against the FCC. But some have questioned, how does net neutrality come into play? Well, back in 2010, the network transparency rules as part of net neutrality are still remain in place after Verizon's lawsuit, mean that the networks must actually disclose their speeds. Lobbyists seem to want a softer interpretation of this, as they want the FCC to enforce that. Cheebert, what do you think? Are ISPs holding up their end of the bargain here?
Well, this is one of those big, big, big arguments. It's kind of like back in the days of whaling and sailing ships. There wasn't a standard for what a barrel of whale oil actually was. It got to the point where the government actually stepped in and said, you know, let's set a standard for the trade in whale oil, because this is a very important thing for our economy. Well, my congressman, sorry guys, there needs to be a standard. The National Institutes of Standards and Technology, I think, really needs to step in because there's so many different speed tests. Keep in mind, remember those old days when we had those PC magazine speed tests? And to judge how fast the PC really was, well, the reality is there were actually some vendors that were cheating. They actually optimized their machines to be able to handle and perform better on the PC magazine speed test. So what we really need to do is start thinking, you know, what is the standard? Speedtest.net performs differently from iPerf. It performs differently from commercial tools. It performs, you know, there's lots and lots and lots of standards out there. And that's what the ISPs are really starting to complain about. Hey, it performs great, quote, on my speed test. How come it doesn't work on yours? Maybe your tool is flawed. So the reality is there are interpretations. And yes, there, you know, no matter what, it's there's differences. But we need to have a stand, you know, we need to be using the same yardstick. We need to have a same ruling on what a megabit per second is under what conditions. That's something that I think we need to do. And yes, net neutrality, I'm sorry, it does a lot of good things and it's really good for the consumer, but a lot of the ISPs don't like it. So we actually had a conversation back in episode 232 on March 24th of this year, when we had one of the folks from the Institute for Local Self-Reliance on the show, and he actually started talking a little bit about speeds and feeds. And so there's just lots of different sides to this story. So my side of the story is we need some standards, and we need to make sure that we're, when we say up to something, we need to actually be saying up to X under what conditions. And that's what one of the things I really think we need to do. So I'm going to toss this back at you, Lou, and say, you know, what's your side of the argument on this?
Yeah, I think it's interesting that you point that out, because I think that you pointed out the kind of the side of the ISP, because they're trying to say that, you know, are the up to really an accurate description of the performance of the service over time, right? I think you're basically saying that's probably not true. That's why they do an up to, because a network and ISP can't guarantee it all the time unless you are a different type of pipe. So I think, you know, that's why that's what you're kind of claiming. And I'm kind of claiming the same thing, is, you know, this goes with services as well. I think, you know, any service that you use, whether it's a Google service or an Oracle service or Microsoft service, they have a certain set of claims, SLA claims, of their service, of their uptime, and, you know, of course, of their performance as well. And, you know, it's not going to be 100% all the time. And so, you know, you might pay for particular tiers of service, but, you know, these tiers, depending on how much you pay, they get tighter. And so if you're in a business tier or a commercial tier, they tend to get more tighter in their actual claims, making that transparent. So I do believe that, you know, a lot of these consumer-based, you know, internet providers, you know, they're going to have a much looser interpretation of what that means. Now, does that mean that they should be providing 40% to 70% less reliability of their network? Absolutely not. And I think that, you know, it's interesting. Somebody in the chat room just pointed out, you know, they would prefer not to worry about the speed, but just that there's no price hikes on there. I think that was Dordu. I don't know. I mean, I guess it makes sense that there's no price hacks, hiking or, you know, hacks on the actual set of speeds. But does that mean that they can go and, you know, not hike a price, but reduce your reliability and your performance? I don't know. I think that this is the argument. This is what you're talking about, Gbert. So I think, you know, obviously they have commercial based tiers that they determine their speeds and they can give you a better SLA. Is this something they're going to, Gbert, that you think that they should be doing for consumer sides too?
Consumer internet is, you know, it's like, oh geez, how do I put it? It's kind of like how the airlines are overbooking. In order to make a profit on fares that cheap on an airline, they have to make sure that every single seat is filled. And so because some people don't make it because of schedules, some people don't make it because of whatevers, they still need to fill those seats. So they overbook. The internet service providers are kind of doing the same thing. They'll oversubscribe a neighborhood, so to speak, so that they can have the smallest amount of infrastructure costs for the maximum amount of profit. And so Chumley and some of the other folks in the chat room brought up something interesting, you know, about standards for Ford Mustangs or standards for a Yugo having 120 mile an hour speedometer, which is totally ridiculous.
Right.
You know, the internet service providers need to be called on carpet. And one of the things that I used to do a lot was back about 10 years ago, we ran a lot of product review shootouts for high-speed networking equipment. And believe me, some of these claims that the vendors made were absolutely atrocious, just not even in the same universe of reality. So we started calling them on the carpet. So Underwriter Laboratories actually has done something very similar for appliances, for cars and things like that. So I am, again, going back to that old soapbox and saying, hey, we need an Underwriter Laboratory for networking that needs to come up with some standards that actually work and a common yardstick that can be used for both commercial and for the consumer side. You know, we need to go and start talking about what is a reasonable amount of oversubscription. And unfortunately, I hate to say it, but I think that's going to require government intervention to go and say, hey, you know, just like the airline industry, you can't overbook more than a certain percent. Well, I think ISPs need to be hit with the same thing. You can overbook, but you can't overbook more than X. Chat room, what do you think? Come on. Give me some love, boys and girls.
I definitely agree. I think there has to be some level, right? I mean, that would be like saying, hey, you know, the without rules, you know, the new 1 gigabyte per second speeds could be half that, maybe even a quarter of that. And, you know, people are paying for the premium, but they're not getting the service reliability. So definitely a slippery slope. Let's hope there's some regulation coming up. And just to note, I'd like to see a Yugo try to go 150 miles an hour. I'd like to see that. But all right, well, we beat that one to death. Let's move on to the next bite. So if you think about it, from Chief Wahoo on the Cleveland Indians to the infamous Eskimo Pie from Cadbury and Dick's Sporting Goods, trademarks can sometimes be offensive and contain deep meanings under different contexts. Think of all the new startups coming up new, and they actually create new ways to create their brands and get them out there. Some of them are just plain out there. The thing that this thing in question is if the courts can prevent people and companies from trademarking things other than that others might find offensive. Well, the Supreme Court finally took a side and they say the government cannot refuse to register trademarks because some of them find the trademark offensive or derogatory. The court unanimously ruled that a law on the books holding that a trademark can't disparage or bring into contempt or disrepute any person's living or dead violates the First Amendment. U.S. Patent and Trademark Office appealed the court to the Supreme Court, and government lawyers argued that trademarks were government speech, not private speech, and that trademarks should be considered as either a form of government subsidy or government program, not citizens' free speech. The high court took the case and decided that it was pure hogwash. As Justice Samuel Alito writes, the proudest boast of our freedom jurisprudence is that we protect the freedom to express the thought that we hate. This rule affects many trademark previously ruled offensive and forced to be removed, especially by state courts. Trademarks from commercial values that have a much more substantial commercial value than such bands like the Slants is that of the NFL team Washington Redskins. The USPTO and federal court had previously ruled that a Redskins mark was subject to cancellation due to anti-disparagement clause. From Mattel versus TAM, the controversial football trademark is likely to be safe from legal cancellation, although not from ongoing criticism. So, Cheever, what's the court actually done here? Have they opened the door to more hate or just more freedom of speech?
You know, this is one of those, you know, nickels balanced on its edge. It can be both good and bad, just like if you pick someone out of the crowd, you've got an equal chance of them being good or evil. This is not one of those things, you know, it's I'm sorry, you know, we've had, even in the indigenous peoples, the Native American community is split on this topic. There were actually some Native American tribes that came out in support of Chief Wahoo and the Cleveland Indians, and some that felt offended. My opinion is we live in a world, especially in America, where we protect the right of someone to stand on a street corner, to yell at the top of their lungs that which makes our blood boil, to burn the symbol of our freedom. But as members of a free society that protect free speech, We must protect their right to protest. I feel that this was a very, very good decision. And I'm slightly offended if someone calls me a slant as being an Asian American. But at the same time, I'm famous for telling, you know, a ethnic joke of how was copper wire invented? Oh, two Chinese guys fighting over a penny. Well, the right to be able to tell ethnic jokes, the right to be able to do things, that's part of being a part of the free society. And I think we need to protect that with our last breath. So that was my last breath. Lou?
Yeah, I agree. I think protection is good. And, you know, it's interesting because this should be actually an interesting pivot on that is that, you know, some of the DNS servers out there and domain registration servers, they sometimes block, you know, strange and offensive. I mean, you know, they do static text analysis and determine whether they think that you're creating an offensive domain or not. So this should be interesting to see, you know, especially if they're US based, if that kind of business will change as well, especially since the court is appealing to that. But we shall see. So for the next bite, we do have some interesting news about SD-WAN and some of the new offerings there. Chibert, why don't you tell us about it?
Well, this is all part of a grand experiment. You know, sometimes we don't need to discuss a press release or anything. And the reality is this new press release from Level 3 actually is pretty stunning. They're announcing the availability of a software-defined WAN connection. You know, obviously, this is not going to be free. This is going to be a service. But being able to do a software-defined WAN through the cloud that is Level 3 means we can do some really, really interesting things. So let me just read this. The new premise-based SD-WAN offering represents the network company's first pure-play SD-WAN product, complementing its pre-existing multi-protocol label switching, MPLS, and hybrid WAN solutions. In a press release issued Tuesday, Level 3 outlined a variety of features for its SD-WAN offering, including but not limited to centralized policy management, rapid site deployment through zero-touch configuration, performance-based routing and traffic steering by application, a single point of contact for broadband aggregation and billing, and a self-service portal and dashboard offering 24/7 application monitoring and analytics. Pretty cool stuff. The company went on to report that its SD-WAN product, which is available today, includes security and privacy features that will enable site-to-site encryption, regardless of access method, backbone connection, or the composition of public and private infrastructure components, all implicated in the press release. As such, the product is anticipated to make for an important fit among Level 3's offerings for enterprise customers. This is huge. You know, one of the things that the federal government did was actually create a cloud just so classified activities can move data around in, you know, a classified fashion. This is very cool. Being able to protect, if you can't even see a site-to-site pipe from the outside world, makes it kind of hard to attack. So Level 3, good stuff. Anyway, so I'm going to start trying to pick out really, really important press releases and add those to our bites. Tell me what you think. Hit me at Twitter, ADVNETLAB. Tell me what you think. Do you like me trying to pick out important press releases? Don't know. Anyway, I'm going to have some fun. I want to throw to Padre this time because we need to go and acknowledge one of our sponsors for this week in enterprise technology. Padre, it's your turn.
Let's take a break one more time to thank another sponsor of This Week in Enterprise Tech. And folks, it's got to be Cloudflare. Now, This Week in Enterprise Tech is brought to you by Cloudflare. Cloudflare is on a mission, folks, to help build a better internet. Cloudflare makes your site or app faster, safer, and more reliable so that you can stop worrying about slow loading page times, downtime, or getting hacked, and instead just concentrate on delivering a fantastic product or service. Cloudflare is incredibly easy to use, and sign up takes less than 5 minutes. They've got a global network of 115-plus data centers, which caches your content and moves it closer to your visitors. Their web optimization features speed up your code and make it more mobile responsive. And end-to-end, Cloudflare speeds up every request to your site with performant DNS, caching, content optimization, load balancing, and more. Cloudflare lets you make your site, app, or API more secure. They don't just provide DDoS protection, even though that's what they're so well known for. But instead, their web application firewall is powered by a massive IP reputation tool that updates for all users. Cloudflare's 24/7 security team is constantly watching for new vulnerabilities and deploying real-time protection. Now, you can also avoid cloud provider lock-in. You may be expecting this to be one of those services where once you join, once you start adding your data, you can never leave without creating a hit, a bump in your service. Not so, because no matter what you choose for your cloud compute, AWS, Azure, Google Cloud, a combination of public or hybrid, Cloudflare will work with all of them. Using Cloudflare gives your business the option to use more than one cloud provider, so you never get locked in to any of them. It also provides flat pricing for everyone. If you're hit with a DDoS attack or if your site suddenly experiences a massive surge in legitimate traffic, you pay the same amount. Their plans range from free, $20 a month, $200 a month, and custom plans for enterprise. And right now, Cloudflare is offering Twit listeners a free online chat session with one of their top support engineers to answer any of your questions. Just visit cloudflare.com/twit to sign up today. That's cloudflare.com/twit. And we thank Cloudflare for their support of This Week in Enterprise Tech.
So let's get to our favorite part of the show. We get to bring in a guest, and he's going to drop some knowledge on the Twilight Riot. And today's guest is no exception. Jeff Sekowitz is a program manager on the Graph API team within the Microsoft Cloud Division, and his focus is on various platforms and capabilities, including the application consent and permissions model, data synchronization, and hybrid deployments. Jeff, welcome to the show today. Can you tell the audience a bit about yourself and your role?
Hey, thanks for having me. So as you mentioned, I'm a PM on the Microsoft Graph team. I'm on the, I guess what you would call the core Graph team. We build a lot of the shared platform capabilities that help developers keep data up to date in their apps, deal with hybrid deployments, get at data with interesting query parameters, things like that. I also work on our application permissions and consent model, like you said.
Got it. So, we've talked about it in the past. We've had a couple episodes. We've mentioned Graph and a little bit about it, but briefly about it. What is this thing called the Graph, and why is it such a big deal?
So the Graph is the gateway to data across Microsoft Cloud services. This data starts with the user, who they are, who they work with, where they live in their organization, what they work on, and then it extends to their content, their emails, their meetings, their activities, things along those lines, their conversations and documents. And then it extends to, and then we have insights. So we have a bunch of machine learning backed insights that can tell you who a person works with most frequently, even if that person doesn't live close to them in an org chart, for example. What documents are being worked on by that person and by people near that they work with commonly, and when they meet most frequently, and kind of give you a view of it can give you a view of all the productivity activities that a person in the organization is engaging in. The graph is also extending into, it kind of started in the productivity and collaboration space, and it's extending into management and into device scenarios as well. So we have, so a lot of the services that back the data I mentioned previously would include Office 365, Azure Active Directory, and inside Office 365, that would include Outlook, SharePoint, OneDrive, OneNote, so on and so forth. We're also extending into Intune. And we have some security APIs in the graph now. And we also announced at Build some pretty exciting APIs around Project Roam that help developers build seamless experiences across many devices for end users. So it's pretty exciting stuff.
So you talked a little bit about, about what the graph is, but why the graph now? What has essentially sparked its creation that we didn't have before?
It's a good question. So we had at Microsoft, we had a lot of different APIs that were being used by similar sets of developers to build their apps. And it was painful to have to get multiple tokens and call multiple endpoints and deal with multiple schemas when building applications. And so, in a couple of these different APIs were actually graphs in and of themselves. So we had many APIs, some of which were graphs, and it wasn't a great developer experience. One reason for building the graph was to give a unified developer experience and make it easier to build apps people were already building. But putting all this data behind a single endpoint also allowed us to build a more robust graph of data, for lack of a better term. So, you can do things, now you can build apps that do things you simply couldn't do before. You can navigate between cloud services that were previously siloed in a single call. And you can get access to all these insights and these new pieces of data that we simply didn't have APIs for before. So now we're, getting into the realm where we want to be able to let people build apps that just they couldn't build in the past.
So Jeff, this is Brian. I'm going to take the place of Joe User here. A lot of the user community is, when you say Microsoft Graph, oh, that's a feature of Excel. Well, you're talking about a whole different animal. I work at a university, and right now I use a lot of MATLAB. I use a lot of Python and things like that. But this is sounding like a large set of tools that allows me to do cross-cloud platform data joins. Is that a good read on where you guys are going?
That is. It's not a graph. One thing that we commonly get confusion on is it's not a graph database, but it's a graph that connects people and productivity and management and device-centric data to each other. So it would, let you get access data that your organization already has, or that your customers already have, or that you already have as an end user. It would let you access that data more easily and unlock the power of the data that's already there more easily, and the data that's being created every day by using Microsoft Cloud Services.
Okay, I actually wanted to go and ask a question from Specs in the chat room. Microsoft's really big. They're pushing very hard on the Internet of Things. And Specs was asking, can IoT roles be included in the graph? Can we pull from the IoT toolkits into Microsoft Graph?
So I will say I'm not super familiar with the IoT toolkits. We have some capabilities in the graph that could be used to drive IoT style experiences, but we haven't onboarded Azure IoT to the graph yet. Graph is the gateway to a lot of the Microsoft Cloud, but not the entire thing yet. So yeah, we don't have integrations with Azure IoT, if that's kind of what the question is.
Yeah, that sounds like it. I think it might be time for a demo, because I think that'll kind of put a lot of things in perspective. What do you think?
Yeah, I think that's a great idea.
Okay, so let's switch to the demo machine and see what we can see.
All right, so this is Graph Explorer. This is a really great tool that we've built that helps people easily start to see what's in the graph and play with data and play with queries without actually writing any code. So I'm logged in here as my demo user, Ben, and I'm going to go ahead and just do a very basic query to get Ben's profile. So I can see just some basic info about Ben, you know, his display name, his job title, his email address, his mobile phone number. We have some pre-canned queries over here. So we have these getting started queries. So I can get his profile, I can get his photo, I can read the messages in his mailbox. And quick note, you didn't see this because I had already used this demo account all the time. But the first time I used Graph Explorer, I was asked to consent to the Graph Explorer reading Ben's information and information about Ben's organization. So this is not something that anybody can walk up to the graph and just start grabbing data about anybody. We take our privacy model very seriously, and everything is consented. So I can see some basic info about Ben, see his messages, see who his manager is, see some documents that are trending around Ben that he might be interested in. And if I want to just dig into all the different pieces of data, I can come in here and turn on these toggles. So let's say I'm interested in Planner and Outlook Mail and OneDrive and OneNote. Now I have all these pre-canned queries that make it really easy for me to see what's in the graph without actually writing any code. So let's dig into this a little further, and I'll start to demonstrate some of the value that you get, that the graph provides. So here I'm just looking at Ben's basic profile, and this information all comes from Azure Active Directory. But due to the nature of the graph, I can see more. So let's go ahead, and you can see I'm just using a standard OData select query. And I'm going to get his mail, display name, and his office location. And that's, again, all from Azure AD. But now, let's get some data. Let's mix in some SharePoint skills, his My Site information, and his mailbox settings from Exchange. And now you can see this all comes back in one easy query. So previously, this call I just made, you would have had to call three separate APIs, three separate tokens, and integrate three times. And now we've taken that down to a single point of integration. I can also start to get some more interesting information if I hop into the beta endpoint, which is, so V1, if an API is in V1, it means it's ready for use in production applications. If it's in beta, it's something that we've put out there, we want to get feedback on, there may be breaking changes, and this is where we basically put our new stuff that we're ready to expose to the public, but not ready to take to prime time. So I'm also going to add on identity user risk. And now I can see whether there's been any risky activity pertaining to Ben's account. And I can see, I scrolled right by it. So I can see that I had a medium level risk event back in March. And then I had a low level risk event back in May. So I can mix all these different pieces of data together that previously were locked up in different silos of the cloud. I can also do interesting navigations. So I can jump into Ben's OneDrive, and I can look at all the files, and I can find a file that's interesting to me. Let's pick one here. This Trey Research Sales Info PowerPoint. I can grab this file. And then I can query on the file. And then I can seamlessly jump to the user profile. Oops.
Live demos, right?
Right. Let's see. I also have this handy history here, and I ran this before. Let's see.
That's cool.
Yeah, so that, so this is actually really handy. I'll go back to that for a second so you can see. If you're playing around in here and you eventually find the perfect query for what you're doing, and you know, you don't have to worry about copying and pasting it somewhere before you move on and try some other stuff, you can always come back to this history and see all your queries that you ran previously. So, okay, so this worked. I don't know what I was doing wrong there. So what's
hey, Jeff,
what I did here?
This is Brian. I'd like to call out a question from the chat room. They're asking, what about non-Microsoft? Can we start playing with pulling in development tools from, say, like different flavors of SQL, Hadoop, other language, other toolkits or tools like PHP, Python, and so forth? Where are you guys on integrating third-party tools?
So as far as – it's kind of – I'll address that in two parts. So – you can use the graph, the API itself. So it's just a REST API. So any platform you use that talks REST, as far as what you're developing in, can talk to the graph. We're completely platform language agnostic. As far as pulling in data from other sources, we don't have today the ability to hook up graph like and to extend graph with a SQL database or Hadoop cluster, for example. However, we do have extensions in the graph. We have an extensibility model where you can add your own data to the graph on an instance-by-instance basis. So you couldn't like do something where you had like slash SQL table and you know, have the entire, you know, your entire SQL database replicated in the graph. But what you could do, and I'll show you, is if you want to hop back to the demo. I'm going to show some extensibility samples here. What you could do is add some custom data to the graph. So let's say you have an app that wants to roam users' UI preferences. So if they like the dark theme and they prefer the color purple or green and they prefer their and they speak Japanese, you want to persist this across an app that's built on the graph without having to ask the user every time or store data locally. You can actually add this. So I'm going to post this to the graph. What this is going to do is create an extension, a schema extension on the user object. And it's actually going to go ahead and extend Ben's user profile with that information I just added. So now I can read Ben's profile back. And now when I read his profile, in addition to all that information I had before, I have his roaming settings. So big answer. Hopefully that covered what the what you were wanting to know.
So I did have another question from Specs in the chat room, and they're actually asking, you know, what's the barrier of entry here? Obviously, the Graph Explorer seems cool. You have to you sign into your account. What's the next barrier? Is it somebody who can play with it without an account? Can they, you know, how do they integrate it with Visual Studio? What's kind of the story there?
That's a good question. So, yeah, we have some experiences in Visual Studio that make it really easy to get up and running. So, you know, we have some pre-built connections there. We also have all sorts of samples and SDKs that you can find right on our documentation page, right at the top on graph.microsoft.com. And yeah, you can, if you click on samples and SDKs, right to the right of documentation on the header. Yeah, so we have all these. In order to build, so that's part of it, is getting, you know, set up. And also you can just use REST if that's your, if that's your flavor. But you also, so basically, yeah, you need some sort of Microsoft account, whether that's a commercial or a consumer account, but you can sign up for free. You know, Graph is totally free to use, free to develop against. There's no paywall or anything like that. And you just need to register your app with our identity platform, and then you're good to go. And registration is free as well.
Got it. So I think one thing to do, I don't know if you might be pop back to the Graph Explorer too, is one thing is and this is one thing I learned when I moved to the team, is the Graph Explorer offers the ability, if you weren't signed in, like if you were to click sign out, you don't have to, but if you click sign out, it does give the option to do sample queries against what our demo account. So there's a demo account that will just show up immediately, and you'll actually able to run these sample queries against it. So you don't even have to sign in to any one of your accounts to actually get that data. So that's kind of again, lowers the barrier of entry, especially against the REST API, so that you can see just how these things are executing and what the return, you know, what's returning. So this way you can understand how that's working without actually having to log in. So that's kind of again, lowers that barrier of entry for it. And like you showed before, there's tons of samples and SDKs that have to do with specific languages, integration, Visual Studio, and that sort of thing. So what sorts of things, I know that there's a lot of, we call them workloads, but there's lots of different things as part of the graph today. You know, what types of things, is the graph planning, and you know, what can you share?
Yeah, so a really good way to see what is coming next in our pipeline is to look at the beta API. This is where we, incubate things that we want to bring, bring forward and make available to developers for use in, production customer-ready apps. So a couple things in there are we have some APIs for Microsoft Teams. We have the Project Roam APIs I mentioned previously. We have a whole bunch of Intune APIs around device enrollment, managed application management. And we have a whole bunch of AAD. We're starting to get more deep into the EMS space. So we have a whole bunch of AAD premium features that are exposed as APIs, like identity protection that I showed in the demo, privileged identity management, we're starting to get more into that management and security space, in addition to continuing to beef up the productivity centric APIs we have.
Very cool.
And we're also constantly adding more, so that kind of touches the data set side. And another way to break down the graph is you have data sets and insights, and then you have capabilities. So you have just, like OData query parameters and the extensions that I showed. We also have batch capabilities that are in beta right now. So you can batch calls together, and you can actually say here's five calls, and the result of operation one will dictate how operation two happens, and things like that. We're also beefing up our array of webhooks. So we have both Delta Query and webhooks that help developers keep track changes and keep data up to date in their apps, and it's commonly used to sync data. And we have some new webhooks for users and groups that are in preview in beta right now. So we're also, always working on our capabilities as well.
Well, of course, I'm always looking forward to the new capabilities as well. So, well, folks, that does it for the show. Unfortunately, you've wasted another hour of the best dang enterprise show, according to 9 out of 10 nodes on the graph. But that was Jeff Sekwitz, program manager at Graph, the Graph API team. Thank you so much for joining us, taking time out of your day and joining us. We definitely want to have you back on, because there's tons of stuff that's Graph going to do and it's going to come up. So we definitely want to have you back on. But it was really a pleasure having you coming this time. Jeff, where can people find you and your work?
The best thing to do is keep an eye on our main documentation page. I'm not super active on Twitter. I probably should be. Keep an eye on our docs page. We'll link out to all our blogs and stuff from there. There's a change log on there, so you can see the new things we're adding. Channel 9 is a good spot as well. We did a bunch of videos for Build, and we'll continue putting content there.
Great. Thanks, Jeff. Thanks so much for coming. Of course.
Thanks for having me.
Absolutely. And of course, we can't do this show without my co-host in crime, who's also our tireless producer of This Week in Enterprise Tech, Mr. Brian Chi. He's the director of the Advanced Network Computing Laboratory in Honolulu. Chibert, can you tell the folks at home where they can find you and your work, and maybe where they can find some maker goodness?
Well, the Honolulu Maker Faire is between noon and 5 p.m. tomorrow at Iolani School in the Sullivan Center. Admission is free. Come one, come all. But more importantly, for the Twiat Riot, this show and hopefully a few more in the future, we are trying to line up some key players in the industry for a series of shows. So we're actually going to be deep diving into various Microsoft Graph features, so that instead of the 10,000-foot view, we're going to start dropping down and going into more details so that we can provide the value. We have had lots of feedback from the viewers that they would like to have more detail, especially on emerging technology. So we're going to try and do that. I am also negotiating the same thing with Google and the same thing with VMware. So that ought to be fun. As time goes on, we're going to be lining up more and more on a regular basis so that you can count on having deep dives into emerging technology, especially as it starts getting announced. And the third bite today was kind of an experiment to try and put in press releases. So right hot off the press, just actually sent to me just a couple days ago. So we're going to start trying to throw things like that in so that you know what's happening, what's going to emerge. We are also negotiating with a couple of companies to start using Twiat as a mechanism for making announcements. So in some cases, you, the Twiat Riot, are going to hear about this before anyone else in the world. So stay tuned, people.
Thanks, Brian. That was Brian Chi, my good friend and the director of the Advanced Network Computing Laboratory in Honolulu. Check out his Maker Faire, and of course also check out his Twitter feed, and if you, like he said, if you have any suggestions about the show or want to talk about something specific or want somebody on, definitely hit that man up. But folks, we have to thank you too, because you come back each and every week and we couldn't do this show without you. And of course, we want to make it easier for you and your friends and family to watch and get the Enterprise This Week in Enterprise Tech information each and every week. So just go ahead to our show notes, show page at twit.tv/Twiat. There we will find all of our back episodes, as well as full episode show links, stories, as well as the name of our guests and also very other helpful topics. But more importantly, next to the videos, there's that magic button there, the subscribe to format of your choice, whether it's audio, video, HD video, to the device of your choice, whether it's your phone, tablet, or laptop or desktop. Also, don't be afraid to share Twiat with your friends and family. Share it out. Send that link. Have them subscribe. Also, remember, we do the show live every week at 1:30 Pacific Standard Time at live.twit.tv. And of course, if you're going to watch it live, you might as well jump into our chat room. irc.twit.tv. We always get really great questions and really great comments, and sometimes we just kind of veer the show in a different direction due to that. So definitely check that out. Of course, we also want to thank everyone who makes this show possible, to the engineers at Twiat, as well as especially Leo and Lisa, who allowed us to and continues to allow us week after week to do this show and supports us each week at This Week Enterprise Tech. And of course, thank you to our tireless producer, Gbert. He, again, gets all the guests and gets all the information for us and gets it all set up. And we couldn't do the show without him. And, again, also thank you. There he is. And, of course, thank you to our TDs this week. Guys, what you guys doing over there in that that empty studio?
It's just me. eating leftovers. Yeah.
Fantastic. Exciting.
Can't let food go to waste.
You guys live exciting lives over there in the back studios there. Thanks, Kevin. Appreciate it. Well, folks, you can always find me at twitter.com/LouMM, and you can check all the things I'm working at. Also, don't forget to check out graph.microsoft.io and check out the Graph Explorer at aka.ms/GE. And you can check all the cool things you can do on the graph and that I'm working on. Until next time, I am Louis Maresca saying, if you want to know what's going on in the enterprise, just keep twiting.